Today is Thursday, August 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris make their public debut and come out swinging in a race for the White House.
Is anyone surprised Donald Trump has a problem with a strong woman or strong women across the board?
Joe, I'm so proud to stand with you. And I do so mindful of all the heroic and ambitious women before me, whose sacrifice, determination, and resilience makes my presence here today even possible.
What's next for leadership in Lebanon in the wake of the catastrophic explosion in Beirut? Also ahead, a race to clean up a massive oil spill off a pristine Indian Ocean coast. It's all on today's International Edition. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris made their first public appearance together Wednesday since Biden chose Harris as his running mate on the Democratic presidential ticket. AP correspondent Sagar Magani has more.
In Kamala Harris,
I have no doubt that I picked the right person to join me.
Biden says the California senator is smart, tough, a proven fighter for the middle class. It was a surreal moment, a mostly empty Delaware high school gym, the backdrop in a grim reminder of the virus pandemic. Harris calls it a moment of consequence for the nation.
Everything we care about, our economy, our health, our children, the kind of country we live in, it's all on the line.
Ripping President Trump's handling of the virus, among other things. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Not long after the appearance, President Trump responded with his own criticism of Biden's choice of Harris.
He made a choice. He picked her. I watched her. I watched her poll numbers go boom, 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 down to almost nothing. And she left angry. She left mad.
Joining us now is Valerie Sperling, professor of political science at Clark University in Massachusetts. She's the co-author of a book on sexism in American politics called Trumping Politics as Usual, Masculinity, Misogyny, and the 2016 Elections. Thank you so much for being with us. So is it fair to say that Joe Biden's choice of Kamala Harris has real historical significance?
It's an exciting moment in American politics. It's a moment at which we've been having a lot more attention to sexism and to racism. Not that those things didn't exist before, but I think finally between the Me Too movement and the Black Lives Matter movement, we've been seeing some shift, you know, in the United States towards taking these two issues seriously. And I think that Biden's choice of the first Black woman to be chosen as vice president on a major party ticket, the first Asian American woman to be chosen.
Biden himself mentioned that he hopes that little girls woke up, girls of color, that they could feel like they had a future that could be anything they wanted, basically. A pretty special moment.
This really is a big shift to have one of the two major parties take this step.
I thought it was also interesting that Biden pointed out that it was exactly 1 year ago a white nationalist group was in Charlottesville chanting Nazi slogans and reminding in his speech the president said that there were very fine people on both sides.
It will be really interesting in the light of that and in the light of what's been going on in the United States with the Black Lives Matter movement and so on to see what the Trump campaign lobs at Kamala Harris and at Biden for choosing Kamala Harris. You know, already Trump has called her nasty and has called her disrespectful. These kinds of things, just, you know, calling Black female politicians too ambitious or abrasive or insufficiently apologetic, all those kinds of things are just giving voice, I think, to deep-seated white biases about Black women and their proper roles and behaviors. There's just all this sort of racist, you know, material that I would expect the Trump campaign to be lobbing at Kamala Harris. And also he used the word radical. And I have a feeling that radical, socialist, communist, I feel like all of these words are now being used as kind of a dog whistle to indicate the Black Lives Matter movement. I think that he's trying to paint her, you know, as far left as a way to alarm moderate voters and certainly to alarm the right wing.
Do you think that at this moment in the nation's history, that that message will resonate?
That's a great question. I think the message obviously does resonate with Trump's base voters. And, you know, here's the thing about American politics. It hasn't tended to matter very much at all who the vice presidential candidate is. The pick of the vice presidential candidate doesn't traditionally have much of an impact on whether that party, you know, wins or loses the presidential election. In other words, Democrats are going to vote for the Democratic ticket and Republicans are going to vote for the Republican ticket. The question is, does this pick signals something to the very few, increasingly few people in the middle. So, and I think that it probably does. I suspect that Biden liked Kamala Harris as a pick, having been a district attorney, the attorney general of California. I suspect that this sends a sort of law and order message to moderate Democrats. So I suspect that, you know, the racist tropes and things will appeal to a certain set of people, but that other people will be reassured by this pick, and also that other people will be really excited about it.
Well, you mentioned, you know, usually the vice presidential pick doesn't necessarily make any difference for voters, but could that be different this time around, given Biden's age, concerns of younger voters, worried about climate, racial justice, healthcare, the pandemic?
I think it could matter, certainly in the context of the pandemic, right, which has brought a lot of the masculinity stuff to the fore. And I think women are seen as being more capable of handling healthcare issues. So it may be that having a woman on the ticket would be reassuring to some voters who feel that the very risky and dangerous and deadly path that's been taken by the current administration, maybe that would be different in Biden's hands and perhaps in the hands of a female vice president. But yes, I mean, I think considering Biden's age, that has to be a factor. You know, even if people assume that he's going to be in good shape for that first 4 years, it's really a question whether an 81-year-old, if he wins, could successfully run for a second term. It might be assumed that she would be stepping into that role and running for president. So it could make a real difference.
You were just talking about the attacks against Harris that will probably continue to ramp up. I thought it was interesting, Biden's introduction to her. He talked a lot about having her back. It's a message that I've been hearing a lot from other women that he didn't pick that said, we've got to all have her back. It sounds to me like they're all anticipating that, but I just thought it was unusual that the presumptive presidential nominee would be having the back of the vice president rather than the other way around.
That's really interesting. I think what Biden was signaling there was that he understands that he's living in a country where racism and sexism are very much a part of politics, including, you know, presidential politics. Elizabeth Warren said something interesting when she dropped out of the race that I think really kind of sums it up. She said, thinking about sexism and how sexism is going to be lobbed at women who were at or close to the top of the ticket. She said, if you say there was sexism in this race, everybody calls you a whiner. Mm-hmm. And if you say, oh, no, there was no sexism, about a bazillion women say, what planet do you live on? So I think Biden, in saying that, I think he's indicated that he knows what planet they live on and that he is prepared for that onslaught that Kamala Harris is likely to face.
Valerie Sperling, professor of political science at Clark University in Massachusetts and co-author of the book Trumping Politics as Usual, Masculinity, Misogyny in the 2016 Elections. Lebanon's protests already have brought down two successive governments in the space of 9 months, analysts pointing to the strength of people power in the nationwide demonstrations and their demands for change, as well as the vulnerability of the country's long-entrenched ruling elite. But some argue the revolution has not yet succeeded in raising up alternative leadership, while others point to new political parties and coalitions already being formed as a sign of what lies ahead. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Middle East Institute President Paul Salem credits Lebanon's vibrant civil society and protests demanding change with shaking and removing some of the ruling elite from power. Now, Iran-backed Hezbollah is also vulnerable because political cover provided by Lebanon's presidency and parliament speaker has been undermined. But Salem wonders if leaders will arise from the protest ranks able to topple entrenched former warlords and other oligarchs to steer Lebanon into a new and needed political direction.
The regime, the oligarchy, the system, it is obviously a very, very profound crisis, which logically creates opportunities for change. But it is difficult and very complicated. There's intense pressure to seize this opportunity to form an independent government, a government that is not beholden to the current parties, and that it be given extraordinary legislative powers for a set number of issues for a set amount of time to get something done. The revolution has not managed to raise up alternative leaders that really can take the place of the corrupt oligarchy.
Maha Yahya, who directs the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, says alternative leadership has been in the process of building up since 2015, when Lebanese poured into the streets without being prompted by their political parties, and the latest crisis has sparked more development in coalition and leadership building.
It takes time. It's a nascent movement. However, already we're seeing new political parties emerge, initiatives, put forward coalitions on the basis of a charter on shared principles, trying to work out a vision for where Lebanon could be and how it could get there. I know of at least 2 to 3 political parties that have already been formed.
Yahya says at the moment, Lebanon has neither the capacity to take on Hezbollah or its weapons. But serious talks are happening on how to move the damaged, debt-ridden country out of the political and economic quagmire it is in and onto more stable terrain, while you prepare the medium to long-term transition to a healthier approach to governance without destabilizing, a return to arms, or a complete breakdown. Del Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Protesters formed human chains and marched through the streets of Belarus, carrying flowers Wednesday in anger at a crackdown by strongman President Alexander Lukashenko that has prompted the European Union to consider new sanctions against Minsk. Four security forces have clashed with protesters for 3 consecutive nights after Lukashenko claimed a landslide re-election victory in a vote Sunday that his opponents say was rigged. An outcry is rising in Somalia as Parliament considers a bill that would allow child marriage once a girl's sexual organs mature and would allow forced marriage as long as the family gives their consent. The bill is a dramatic reworking of years of efforts by civil society to bring forward a proposed law to give more protections to women in one of the world's most conservative countries. The UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence in Conflict says the bill would represent a major setback in the fight against sexual violence in Somalia and across the globe. China's global economic power makes the communist country in some ways a more difficult foe to counter than the Soviet Union during the Cold War. That from U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking to Czech lawmakers Wednesday in a speech in Prague. Pompeo called on countries around Europe to rally against the Chinese Communist Party, which he said leverages its economic might to exert its influence around the world. Cleanup crews are scrambling to contain a massive oil spill off the Indian Ocean nation of Mauritius. The Japanese-owned ship Wakashio hit a reef in late July, leaking tons of oil into the sea on the southeast coast of the island. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to journalist Nod Sivaraman, director of publication for Los Sentinel Media Group in Port Louis, Mauritius.
Since yesterday, there's a serious risk of a ship being torn into 2 pieces because it's really in bad shape. So everything has been done to pump out the oil from the Wakashio. Right now, at the time I'm talking to you, we still have 300 tons of heavy oil on board. But that's a good progress because from the get-go, they had like 2,500 metric tons of fuel on board. 1,000 went, as we know, sadly, into the ocean. They think they will finish the pumping of all the oil by tonight. So the risk that there will be more pollution is going down.
As you've said, there's already a huge amount of oil that has leaked into the ocean around southeast Mauritius. What does that look like? What's the impact of that so far on the environments there?
So you can see large black spots on what used to be pure crystalline blue-green waters. You know, this spot, the southeast of Mauritius, it's like postcard. It's known for its wildlife, but also for the water, the pristine waters and the white sandy beaches. So nowadays, people have said it's no more Blue Bay. Blue Bay is next to where the Wakashio went onto the reef. So it's Black Bay. Everything, it's turned black. The white sandy beaches are now all black. So it's a very, very sad picture. People are heartbroken because we have never seen Mauritius in such a state before. And people have a lot of questions. They are angry, and they are asking themselves, how come such a big ship came on our shore into our territorial waters without us being in the know? No one knew this ship was coming on us. No radar, the police did not know. It's only after the crash on the 25th of July at 1925 that local people started to share the pictures that the local authorities got aware of a situation and started to, you know, get their acts together.
And what is the response looking like, both from the regular people and from the government?
People are trying to help, you know, because the government said we don't have enough equipment. This saw a spontaneous movement from citizens from all walks of life trying to come and collect the fuel which is being washed on our shores. So it's more like a bottom-up movement that we are witnessing in Mauritius. Citizens have come to realize that government is not equipped. Government did not do things in a proper fashion, because it's only 12 days after the wreckage that they are doing the salvage operation. So people are trying to help with their own little means. They are building booms with straws, with plastic bottles. They are collecting, you know, the heavy oil with small buckets. And, you know, it's a very sad scene.
Nad Sivaraman, director of publication for La Centennial Media Group in Mauritius, speaking to VOA's Jason Patinkin. Thousands of Israelis have continued to rally outside Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's residence in Jerusalem as anger mounts over corruption allegations and his handling of the coronavirus. The protest movement has intensified in recent weeks and brought out a new breed of protesters. Joining us to talk about the protests is Libby Lenkinsky, Vice President for Public Engagement at the New Israel Fund. Thank you for being with us. I know you just returned from 5 weeks in Israel and witnessed some of this. Tell us about what you experienced and saw.
In some ways, I feel like I lived through it twice, because I came out of sheltering in place in New York City right into the George Floyd Black Lives Matter protest. So my first time in a crowd in a whole bunch of months here in New York City was going to those protests here in Brooklyn. And then I went to Israel at a moment when it looked like there was a window, because it seemed like the government had the coronavirus crisis mostly under control. And so people were allowed back out, things were reopened, and that seemed like a good time to go and see my family. And so I got on a plane 5 weeks ago, knowing that I would have to be in quarantine for 2 weeks. And as I was coming out of quarantine, the information started to come out about the mishandling of the crisis and of the reopening. The Israeli government really moved to reopen very dramatically. So it was within days that everything was really reopened, from synagogues to large events, to schools. And then we saw a massive spike in numbers. And people really felt like the 2+ months that they were asked to shelter in place. And by the way, the sheltering in place in Israel, especially in the major cities like Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, was very intense. It was more strict in some ways than what I experienced in New York City. So there were several days, and in some places several weeks, where people were asked to stay within 100 meters of their homes, you know, and really be inside as much as possible. And then moving from that to just like this massive reopening created a spike in numbers, and people started to ask a lot of questions and then become really outraged about the fact that those 2+ months that they were asked to be at home and not go more than a very small distance from their house was completely in vain, that the government had squandered all that time by reopening so dramatically and so quickly. And people started to ask questions about why and whose interests was this actually serving. happening. And people started to pour out into the streets, in particular around Prime Minister Netanyahu's residence in Jerusalem on Balfour Street. And, you know, the initial rage really was dealing with corruption because, of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu is facing several indictment charges, but is still managing to keep his position and not face trial. And people are outraged about that. And so the kind of first messages of this protest were about mishandling of the coronavirus crisis and also the government corruption.
When did the initial protests begin?
It's very grassroots. The first ones that I was aware of were in response to instructions from the government that were saying that restaurants and nightclubs were going to have to close back down after reopening. And while other institutions like synagogues were staying open, there were some early protests about that. And then I would say it was a matter of a few days to 1 week until much bigger protests were starting to happen around Prime Minister Netanyahu's residence. But this is all kind of on the back of a movement that has been growing for a couple of years now around corruption. So the response to the reclosing got a big pickup from this anti-corruption movement that has been growing over the last couple of years.
Are the protests continuing? And it sounds like they're getting bigger and bigger with people in the thousands.
Absolutely. And you hear chants on the ground in Jerusalem saying, "We won't give up until he goes," as well as chants that say, "An entire generation demand a future. Dor shalem doresh atid." And they seem unrelenting. They seem very, very committed. And it is also growing both in numbers and in diversity. So these are really democratized, really grassroots protests. They don't have like official organizers. There isn't an official stage. It's just people coming from all over Jerusalem and all over the country with handmade signs with all kinds of messages on them. So if the first wave was all about Netanyahu and corruption, and you saw people wearing masks that say "Crime Minister" and things like that. By week two, there were also signs about where are the women in handling the coronavirus crisis? Because when you see the decision-making cabinet in the emergency government, it's all men. And, you know, last week I saw signs about justice for Iyad al-Khalik, the Palestinian East Jerusalemite who was shot the same weekend as George Floyd, together with justice for Salah Monteca, the Ethiopian Israeli teenager who was shot last summer, who sparked a protest movement of young Ethiopian Israelis demanding justice and an end to police violence, all those things combining in the square. And as the protests grow and as time goes, more and more messages and more people are flowing into that. So it really feels like a massive call for change that's unspecific in some way. The big protests are happening on Saturday night each week in Jerusalem, outside of Prime Minister Netanyahu's residence. But I also will say both weeks driving from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, we saw people protesting on the bridges over the highways, and that's apparently happening all around the country. So on Saturdays, as Shabbat ends, as people are making their way towards the big protest in Jerusalem, people are also making their way to these bridges that are over the highways all over the country and standing there with flags and honking car horns in solidarity with the protest.
Libby Lenkinsky, Vice President of Engagement with the New Israel Fund. Thank you for being with us. Meanwhile, Netanyahu denies any wrongdoing and has accused protesters of trampling democracy and the Israeli media of encouraging dissent. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Oh.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Black Lives Matter protests worldwide have toppled statues and targeted streets and buildings linked to slavery and are increasingly sparking acknowledgement by banks and businesses of ties to the grim history. But critics say corporate soul-searching is not happening in France. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
AXA insurance company Banque de France and the maker of Hennessy Cognac. These very different institutions have one thing in common, according to a new investigation by France's Le Monde newspaper. All are tied directly or indirectly with slavery. Le Monde reports they count among a number of French corporations that have not acknowledged such links. At a time when companies are becoming socially and environmentally responsible, the newspaper wrote, why not accept their historical responsibility? Two of the companies, AXA and the Banque de France, could either not be reached or did not immediately respond to VOA.
Cela ne me surprend absolument pas. Nous avons nous-mêmes essayé de contacter les grandes familles bordelaises.
Bordeaux-based activist Karfa Diallo, who conducts tours of the city's slave trading past, says he is not surprised by the silence. His association, Mémoire et Partage, has also tried to contact local businesses with similar historical links with no success. Louis Georgetin, honorary president of Black Activist Umbrella Association CAN, offers one explanation.
France is a very arrogant country. In the elite, most people will tell you, of course, within the population, we are the country of human rights. So why should we apologize when we are so great?
France ended slavery and the slave trade in the 19th century, but there was a time when it was one of Europe's top slave trading countries. So was nearby England. Now, a growing number of prominent British banks and businesses are beginning to acknowledge past links to the slave business, including in recent weeks. In the United States, too, the Black Lives Matter protests have cast new scrutiny on businesses and places like New York's Wall Street, which was once a slave market. Still, French historian Myriam Cotillas says she can understand corporate silence here. It can sometimes be hard to draw clear historical links with French businesses today.
It's not clear, even for me, the exact organization from the slavery to the present. And I think, and maybe it's one of the reasons why there is no acknowledgement or any apology.
Still, activists say France is beginning to face its past in other ways. A slavery museum is to be built in Paris, and a new foundation for the memory of slavery was launched earlier this year. Banque de France subsidiaries are helping to finance it in what some say is at least an indirect acknowledgement of history. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And finally today, Hank Williams Jr., Marty Stewart, and songwriter Dean Dillon are the newest inductees to the Country Music Hall of Fame. The Country Music Association made the announcement on Wednesday. Williams will join his father, country legend Hank Williams Sr., in the Hall of Fame's rotunda. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bungani, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks for listening.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. It's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And the AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Hello.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Hey,